Man has become so rational, so utilitarian, that the trickle becomes most pale and thin. It is efficient for mere survival, but it screens out the most wondrous part of man's potential experience without his even knowing it. We are shut off from our own world. Primitive man once experienced the rich and sparkling flood of the senses fully. Children experience it for a few months, until normal training, conditioning, close the doors on this other world, usually for good. Somehow, Huxley had said, the drugs opened these ancient doors, and through them modern man may at last go and rediscover his divine birthright. But these are words, man, and you couldn't put it into words. The white smocks liked to put it into words like hallucination and dissociative phenomena. They could understand the visual skyrockets, give them a good case of an ashtray turning into a Venus flytrap or eyelid movies of crystal cathedrals, and they could groove on that. Kluver, op. sit, page 43, note. That was swell. But don't you see, the visual stuff was just the decor with LSD. In fact, you might go through the whole experience without any true hallucination. The whole thing was the experience, this certain indescribable feeling. Indescribable because words can only jog the memory, and if there is no memory of the experience of the barrier between the subjective and the objective, the personal and the impersonal, the I and the not I disappearing, that feeling. Or can you remember when you were a child watching someone put a pencil to a sheet of paper for the first time to draw a picture, and the line begins to grow into a nose? And it is not just a pattern of graphite line on a sheet of paper, but the very miracle of creation itself, and your own dreams float into that magical, growing line. And it was not a picture, but a miracle, an experience. And now that you're soaring on LSD, that feeling is coming on again, only now the creation is of the entire universe. Meanwhile, over on Perry Lane, this wasn't precisely the old searching hick they all knew and loved. Suddenly, Kesey, well, he was soft-spoken all right, but he came on with a lot of vital energy. Gradually, the whole Perry Lane thing was gravitating around Kesey. Volunteer Kesey gave himself over to science over at the Menlo Park Vets Hospital. And somehow drugs were getting up and walking out of there and over to Perry Lane. LSD, mescaline, IT-290 mostly. Being hip on Perry Lane now had an element nobody had ever dreamed about before. Wild-flying, mind-blowing drugs. Some of the old Perry Lane luminaries' cool was tested, and they were found wanting. Robin White and Gwen Davis were against the new drug thing. That was all right, because Kesey had had about enough of them, and the power was with Kesey. Perry Lane took on a kind of double personality, which is to say, Kesey's. Half the time, it would be just like some kind of college fraternity row, with everybody out on a nice autumn Saturday afternoon on the grass in the dapple shadows of the trees and honeysuckle tendrils playing touch football or basketball. An hour later, however, Kesey and his circle would be hooking down something that in the entire world only they and a few avant-garde neuropharmacological researchers even knew about. Drugs of the future, of the neuropharmacologist's centrifuge utopia, the coming age of... Well, shit. And I don't reckon we give much of a damn anymore about the art of living in France either, boys. Every frog ought to have a little paunch, like Henry Miller said, and go to bed every night in pajamas with collars and piping on them. Just take a letter for me and mail it down to old Morris at Morris Orchards, Laredo, Texas, boys. Tell him about enough peyote cactus to mulch all the moldering widows' graves in poor placid Palo Alto. Yes. They found out they could send off to a place called Morris Orchards in Laredo and get peyote. And one of the new games of Perry Lane, goodbye Robin, goodbye Gwen, got to be seeing who was going down to the railway express at the railroad station and pick up the shipment. Since possession of peyote, although not of LSD, was already illegal in California. There would be these huge goddamned boxes of the stuff, 1,000 buds and roots, $70. Buds only, slightly higher. If they caught you, you were caught, because there was no excuse possible. There was no other earthly reason to have these goddamned fetid plants except to get high as a coon. And they would all set about cutting them into strips and putting them out to dry. It took days. and then grinding them up into powder and packing them in gelatin capsules or boiling it down to a gum and putting it in the capsules or just making a horrible goddamn broth that was so foul, so unbelievably vile, you had to chill it numb to try to kill the taste and fast for a day so you wouldn't have anything on your stomach just to keep 8 ounces of it down. But then, sore. Perry Lane, Perry Lane. Miles, 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 under all that good vegetation from Morris Orchards, and having visions of faces, 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 so many faces, rolling up behind the eyelids, faces he has never seen before, complete with spectral cheekbones, pregnant eyes, stringy wattles, and all of a sudden, Chief Broom. For some reason, Peyote does this. Keezy starts getting eyelid movies of faces, whole galleries of weird faces, churning up behind the eyelids, faces from out of nowhere. He knows nothing about Indians and has never met an Indian, but suddenly here is a full-blown Indian, Chief Broom, the solution, the whole mothering key to the novel. He hadn't even meant to write this book. He had been working on another one called Zoo, about North Beach. Lovell had suggested why didn't he get a job as night attendant on the psychiatric ward at Menlo Park. He could make some money, and since there wasn't much doing on the ward at night, he could work on Zoo. But Keezy got absorbed in the life on the psychiatric ward. The whole system, if they set out to invent the perfect anti-cure for what ailed the men on this ward, they couldn't have done it better. Keep them cowed and docile. Play on the weaknesses that drove them nuts in the first place. Stupefy the bastards with tranquilizers, and if they still get out of line, haul them up to the shock shop and punish them. Beautiful. Sometimes he would go to work, high on acid. He could see into their faces. Sometimes he wrote, and sometimes he drew pictures of the patients, and as the lines of the ballpoint greasy creased into the paper, the lines of their faces, he could... The interiors of these men came into the lines, the ballpoint crevasses. It was the most incredible feeling. The anguish and the pain came right out front and flowed in the crevasses in their faces. And in the ballpoint crevasses, the same one crevasses now, black starling nostrils, black starling eyes, blind black starling geek cry on every face. Me, 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 I am me. He could see clear into them. And how could you tell anybody about this? They'll say you're a nut yourself. But afterwards, not high on anything, he could still see into people. The novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, was about a roustabout named Randall McMurphy. He is a big, healthy animal, but he decides to fake insanity in order to get out of a short jail stretch he is serving on a work farm and into what he figures will be the soft life of a state mental hospital. He comes onto the ward with his tight, reddish-blonde curls tumbling out from under his cap, cracking jokes and trying to get some action going among these dead asses in the loony bin. They can't resist the guy. They suddenly want to do things. The tyrant who runs the place, Big Nurse, hates him for weakening control and the system. By and by, many of the men resent him for forcing them to struggle to act like men again. Finally, Big Nurse is driven to play her trump card and finish off McMurphy by having him lobotomized. But this crucifixion inspires an Indian patient, a schizoid called Chief Broom, to rise up and break out of the hospital and go sane, namely, run like hell for open country. Chief Broom, the very one. From the point of view of Kraft, Chief Broom was his great inspiration. If he had told the story through McMurphy's eyes, he would have had to end up with the big bruiser delivering a lot of homilies about his down-home theory of mental therapy. Instead, he told the story through the Indian. This way, he could present a schizophrenic state the way the schizophrenic himself, Chief Broom, feels it, and at the same time report the McMurphy method more subtly. Morris Orchids. He wrote several passages of the book under peyote and LSD. He even had someone give him a shock treatment, clandestinely, so he could write a passage in which Chief Broom comes back from the shock shop. Eating Laredo buds, he would write like mad under the drugs. After he came out of it, he could see that a lot of it was junk. But certain passages, like Chief Broom and his schizophrenic fogs, it was true vision, a little of what you could see if you opened the doors of perception, friends. Right after he finished One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Kesey sublet his cottage on Perry Lane, and he and Fay went back up to Oregon. This was in June 1961. He spent the summer working in his brother Chuck's creamery in Springfield to accumulate some money. Then he and Fay moved into a little house in Florence, Oregon, about 50 miles west of Springfield, near the ocean, in logging country. Kesey started gathering material for his second novel, Sometimes a Great Notion, which was about a logging family. He took to riding early in the morning and at night in the crummies. These were pickup trucks that served as buses taking the loggers to and from the camps. At night he would hang around the bars where the loggers went. He was low rent enough himself to talk to them. After about 4 months of that, they headed back to Perry Lane, where he was going to do the writing. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was published in February 1962, and it made his literary reputation immediately. A smashing achievement, Mark Shorer. A great new American novelist, Jack Kerouac. Powerful poetic realism, Life. An amazing first novel, Boston Traveler. This is a first novel of special worth, New York Herald Tribune. His storytelling is so effective, his style so impetuous, his grasp of characters so certain, that the reader is swept along. His is a large, robust talent, and he has written a large, robust book. Saturday Review. And on the lane, all this was a confirmation of everything they and Kesey had been doing. For one thing, there was the old drug paranoia. The fear that this wild, uncharted drug thing they were into would gradually rot your brain. Well, here was the answer. Chief Broom. And McMurphy. But of course. The current fantasy. He was a McMurphy figure who was trying to get them to move off their own snug harbor dead center, out of the plump little game of being ersatz daring and ersatz alive, the middle-class intellectuals game, and move out to Edge City, where it was scary, but people were whole people. And if drugs were what unlocked the doors and enabled you to do this thing and realize all this that was in you, then so let it be. Not even on Perry Lane did people really seem to catch the thrust of the new book he was working on, Sometimes a Great Notion. It was about the head of a logging clan, Hank Stamper, who defies a labor union and thereby the whole community he lives in by continuing his logging operation through a strike. It was an unusual book. It was a novel in which the strikers are the villains and the strike breaker is the hero. The style was experimental and sometimes difficult. And the main source of mythic reference was not Sophocles or even Sir James Fraser, but, yes, Captain Marvel. The union leaders, the strikers, and the townspeople were the tarantulas, all joyfully taking their vow. We shall wreak vengeance and abuse on all whose equals we are not. And will to equality shall henceforth be the name for virtue. And against all that has power we want to raise our clamor. Hank Stamper was, quite intentionally, Captain Marvel, once known as Übermensch, the current fantasy. On Perry Lane. Nighttime, the night he and Fay and the kids came back to Perry Lane from Oregon, and they pull up to the old cottage, and there is a funny figure in the front yard, smiling and rolling his shoulders this way and that, and jerking his hands out to this side and the other side as if there's a different drummer somewhere, different drummer, you understand, corked out of his gourd, in fact. And, well, I can, well, you weren't around exactly, you understand, double-de-clutch, double-de-clutch, and they told me you wouldn't mind, generosity knoweth no, yes, I had a 47 Pontiac myself once, held the road like a prehistoric bird, you understand. And yes, Neil Cassady had turned up in the old cottage, like he had just run out of the pages of On the Road, and what's next, Chief? Ah, many day-glow freaking curlicues. All sorts of people began gathering around Perry Lane. Quite an underground sensation it was in hip California. Kesey, Cassady, Larry McMurtry. Two young writers, Ed McClanahan and Bob Stone. Chloe Scott, the dancer. Roy Seaburn, the artist. Carl Lehmanhaupt, Vic Lovell. And Richard Alpert himself. All sorts of people were in and out of there all the time because they had heard about it, like the local beats. That term was still used. A bunch of kids from a pad called the Chateau. a wild-haired kid named Jerry Garcia, and the cadaverous cowboy, Paige Browning. Everybody was attracted by the strange high times they had heard about. The Lanes fabled venison chili, a keezy dish made of venison stew laced with LSD, which you could consume and then go sprawl on the mattress in the fork of the great oak in the middle of the lane at night and play pinball with the light show in the sky. Perry Lane. And many puzzled souls looking in. At first they were captivated. The lane was too good to be true. It was Walden Pond, only without any Thoreau misanthropes around. Instead, a community of intelligent, very open, out-front people. Out-front was a term everybody was using. Out-front people who cared deeply for one another, and shared, in incredible ways even, and were embarked on some kind of, well, adventure in living. Christ, you could see them trying to put their finger on it, and then, gradually figuring out there was something here they weren't in on. Like the girl that afternoon in somebody's cottage when Alpert came by. This was a year after he started working with Timothy Leary. She had met Alpert a couple of years before, and he had been 100% the serious young clinical psychologist. Legions of rats and cats in cages with their brain stems, corpora callosa and optic chiasmas sliced, spliced, diced, iced in the name of the scientific method. Now Alpert was sitting on the floor in Perry Lane in the old boho lotus hunker down and exegeting very seriously about a baby crawling blindly about the room. Blindly? What do you mean blindly? That baby is a very sentient creature. That baby sees the world with a completeness that you and I will never know again. His doors of perception have not yet been closed. He still experiences the moment he lives in. The inevitable bullshit hasn't constipated his cerebral cortex yet. He still sees the world as it really is, while we sit here, left with only a dim historical version of it manufactured for us by words and official bullshit, and so forth and so on. And Alpert soars in Uspenskayan loop-the-loops for baby, while as far as this girl can make out, baby just bobbles, dribbles, lists, and rocks across the floor. But she was learning that the world is surely divided into those who have had the experience and those who have not, those who have been through that door and... It was a strange feeling for all these good souls to suddenly realize that right here on woody, thatchy little Perry Lane, amid the honeysuckle and dragonflies and boughs and leaves and a thousand little places where the sun peeped through, while straight plodding souls from out of the Stanford Eucalyptus Tunnel plodded by straight down the fairways on the golf course across the way, this amazing experiment in consciousness was going on, out on a frontier neither they nor anybody else ever heard of before. Palo Alto, California, July 21st, 1963. And then one day the end of an era, as the papers liked to put it. A developer bought most of Perry Lane and was going to tear down the cottages and put up modern houses, and the bulldozers were coming. The papers turned up to write about the last night on Perry Lane, noble old Perry Lane, and had the old cliché at the ready, end of an era, expecting to find some deep-thinking latter-day Thorstein Veblen intellectuals on hand with sonorous, bitter statements about this machine civilization devouring its own past. Instead, there were some kind of nuts out here. They were up in a tree lying on a mattress, all high as coons, and they kept offering everybody, all the reporters and photographers, some kind of venison chili, but there was something about the whole setup. And when it came time for the sentimental, bitter statement, well, instead, this big guy Keezy dragged a piano out of his house, and they all set about axing the hell out of it and burning it up, calling it the oldest living thing on Perry Lane, only they were giggling and yahooing about it. High as coons, in some weird way, all of them, hard grabbing off the stars. And it was hard as hell to make the end of an era story come out right in the papers, with nothing but this kind of freaking Olson and Johnson material to work with. But they managed to go back with the story they came with, end of an era, the cliché intact, if they could only blot out the cries in their ears of venison chili. And none of them would have understood it anyway, even if someone had told them what was happening. Keezy had already bought a new place in La Honda, California. He had already proposed to a dozen people on the lane that they come with him, move the whole scene, the whole raggedy manic era, off to Versailles, his low-rent Versailles, over the mountain and through the woods in La Honda, California, where, in the lime, light, and the neon dust, a considerable new message, the blissful counterstroke. Chapter 5. The Rusky Dusky Neon Dust. A very Christmas card, Kesey's new place near La Honda. A log house, a mountain creek, a little wooden bridge, 15 miles from Palo Alto beyond Cahill Ridge, where Route 84 cuts through a redwood forest gorge. A redwood forest for a yard, a very Christmas card. And strategic privacy, not a neighbor for a mile. La Honda lived it Western style. One work-a-daddy hive, a housing tract, but it was back behind the redwoods. The work-a-daddy faces could not be seen from scenic old Route 84. Just a couple Wild West roadside places, Baugh's General Store, the Hilltop Motel, in the Wild West tourist mode, with brown wood signs sawed jagged at the ends, but sawed neat, you know, as if to suggest Wild West roughing it, motoring friends, but sanitized jake seats, ammonia pucks in every urinal. We aim to keep your Wild West sanipure. Who won the West? Antisepsis did, I guess. La Honda's Wild West load seems to be owed to the gunslinging younger brothers. They hold up in town, and dad blame, but they found a neighborly way to pay for their stay. They built a whole wooden store, these notorious mothers, but them was the younger brothers, mere gunslingers. Now this Kesey and his merry humdingers down the road, in the lime light. Early in 1964, just a small group on hand as yet. In the afternoon, Faye, the eternal beatific pioneer wife, in the house, at the stove, at the sewing machine, at the washing machine, with the children, Shannon and Zane, gathered around her skirts. Out in a wooden shack near the creek, Kesey has his desk and typewriter, where he has just finished the revisions on Sometimes a Great Notion, now almost 300,000 words long. Kesey's friend from Oregon, George Walker, is here, a blonde all-American-looking guy in his 20s, well-built, son of a wealthy housing developer. Walker has what is known as a sunny disposition and is always saying too much in the most enthusiastic way. And Sandy Lehman Haupt. Sandy is the younger brother of Carl Lehman Haupt, whom Kesey had known on Perry Lane. Sandy is a handsome kid, 22 years old, tall, lean, high-strung. Sandy had met Kesey 3 months before, November 14, 1963, through Carl, when Kesey had come to New York for the opening of the stage version of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Kirk Douglas played McMurphy. Sandy had dropped out of NYU and was working as a sound engineer. He was a genius with tapes, sound tracks, audio systems, and so forth, but he was going through a bad time. It got to the point where one day he tried to enter himself in a psychiatric ward, only to be talked out of it by Carl, who took him off to see the opening of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And there was Randall McMurphy, Kesey. And Carl asked Kesey to take Sandy out west with him, to La Honda, to get him out of the whole New York morass. And if there was any place for curing the New York thing, this was it, out back of Kesey's in the lime, light, bower. Up the path out back of the house, up the hill into the redwood forest, Sandy suddenly came upon a fabulous bower, like a great domed enclosure. Like what people mean when they talk about a cathedral in the pines, only the redwoods were even more majestic. The way the sun came down through the redwood leaves, trunks and leaves, seemed to stretch up for hundreds of feet above your head. It was always sunny and cool at the same time, like a perfect fall day all year around. The sun came down through miles of leaves and got broken up like a pointillist painting, deep green and dapple shadows, but brilliant light in a soaring deep green super bower, a perpetual lime green light, green and gold afternoon, stillness, perpendicular peace, wood-scented, with the cars going by on Route 84 just adding pneumatic sound effects. Shoo! Like a gentle wind. All peace here. Very reassuring. A few times Sandy and Kesey and Walker would walk up into the forest with axes and cut some wood for the house, but that wasn't really the name of it at Kesey's. Sandy could see that Kesey wasn't primarily an outdoorsman. He wasn't that crazy about unspoiled nature. It was more like he had a vision of the forest as a fantastic stage setting in which every day would be a happening, an art form. He had hi-fi speakers up on the roof of the house, and suddenly, out here in God's great green mountain ozone, erupts a manic spade blowing on a plastic saxophone, namely an Ornette Coleman record. It's a slightly weird path here that the tree loggers take, nutty mobiles hanging from the low branches and a lot of wild paintings nailed up on the tree trunks. Then a huge tree with a hollow base, and inside it, glinting in the greeny dark, here is a tin horse with the tin bent so that the grotesque little animal is keeled over, kneeling in bad shape. The terrain Kesey was most interested in fact, was inside the house. The house was made of logs, but it was more like a lodge than a cabin. The main room had big French doors for a picture window effect, and exposed beams and a big stone fireplace at one end. Kesey had all sorts of recording apparatus around, tape recorders, motion picture cameras, and projectors. And Sandy helped add still more, some fairly sophisticated relay systems and the like. Often the Perry Lane people would drive over, although no one had moved to La Honda so far. Ed McClanahan, Bob Stone, Vic Lovell, Chloe Scott, Jane Burton, Roy Seaburn. Occasionally, Kesey's brother Chuck and his cousin Dale would come down from Oregon. They both resembled Kesey, but were smaller. Chuck was a bright, quiet man, casual and down home. Dale was powerfully built and more completely down home than either. Kesey was trying to develop various forms of spontaneous expression. They would do something like, all lie on the floor and start rapping back and forth, and Kesey puts a tape recorder microphone up each sleeve and passes his hands through the air and over their heads like a sorcerer making signs, and their voices cut in and out as the microphones sail over. Sometimes the results were pretty, well, freaking gibberish to normal human ears, most likely. Or to the receptive standard intellectual who has heard about the 1913 Armory Show and Eric Satie and Edgard Varèse and John Cage, it might sound sort of avant-garde, you know. But in fact, like everything else here, it grows out of the experience with LSD. The whole other world that LSD opened your mind to existed only in the moment itself. Now. And any attempt to plan, compose, orchestrate, write a script only locked you out of the moment, back in the world of conditioning and training where the brain was a reducing valve. So they would try still wilder improvisations, like the human tapes, huge rolls of butcher paper stretched out on the floor. They would take wax pencils, different colors, and scrawl out symbols for each other to improvise on. Sandy, the pink drum strokes there, and he would make a sound like chiuncho. Chiunchung, and so forth. And Kesey the guitar arrows there, broinga broinga brang brang. And Jane Burton the bursts of scat vocals there. And Bob Stone the voiceover stories to the background of the human jazz. All of it recorded on the tape recorder. And then all soaring on what? Acid, peyote, morning glory seeds, which were very hell to choke down. Billions of bilious seeds mulching out into sodden dandelions in your belly, bloated, but soaring, or IT-290, or dexedrine, benzedrine, methadrine, speed, or speed and grass. Sometimes you could take a combination of speed and grass and prop that LSD door open in the mind without going through the whole uncontrollable tumult of the LSD. And Sandy takes LSD and the lime light, and the magical bower turns into neon dust, pointillist particles for sure now. Golden particles, brilliant forest green particles, each one picking up the light, and all shimmering and flowing like an electronic mosaic, pure California neon dust. There is no way to describe how beautiful this discovery is, to actually see the atmosphere you have lived in for years for the first time, and to feel that it is inside of you too, flowing up from the heart, the torso, into the brain, an electric fountain. And IT-290... He and George Walker are up in the big tree in front of the house, straddling a limb, and he experiences intersubjectivity. He knows precisely what Walker is thinking. It isn't necessary to say what the design is, just the part each will do. You paint the cobwebs, Sandy says, and I'll paint the leaves behind them. Too much, says George, because of course he knows. All of us sliding in and out of these combinations of mutual consciousness, intersubjectivity, going out to the back house near the creek with tape recorders and starting to rap. A form of free association conversation, like a jazz conversation, or even a monologue with everyone or whoever catching hold of words, symbols, ideas, sounds, and winging them back and forth and beyond the walls of conventional logic. One of us finds a bunch of wooden chessmen. They are carved figures, some kind of ancient men, every piece an old carved man, only somebody left them outside and they got wet and now they're warped, which sprung them open into their real selves. This one's genitals are hanging out despite he has robes on and carries a spear. Have you seen my daughter? Claims I embarrass her. Claims the whole world knows I have cunt on the brain. At my age. Yes, sir, we have the report. Your daughter's a horny little bitch, but I am the king and I have no choice but to cut your balls off. King, I'll throw you for them. Your balls? Right, with those gold hubcaps you lug about there. Right. In fact, incredible. Each one of us has a chess figure in his hand and becomes that character, and they are rapping off the personalities they see in these figures, and they start thinking the same things at once. I, too, saw these funny little curves under this figure's hand here, no larger than the head of a tiny tack, as golden hubcaps, I was about to say it. It is the strangest feeling of my life, intersubjectivity, as if our consciousness had opened up and flowed together, and now one has only to look at a flicker of the other's mouth or eye or at the chessman he holds in his hand, wobbling. You wouldn't believe a girl with electric eel tits, would you, King? The ones that ionized King Arthur's sword under swamp water? The very ones. Dugs with 1,000 tiny suction caps. A horny, duggy little girl, I'm afraid, 120 household volts of jailbait, if I ever saw one. And how, in the wildest operations of chance, could a term like 120 household volts of jailbait arise in all our minds at once? But the swamps, too. It is no longer all Garden of Eden and glorious discovery for the old Perry Lane crowd. In fact, there's a little grumbling here in the Magic Dell. Keezy is starting to organize our trips. He hands out the drugs personally, one for you and one for you. And just when you're starting to lie back and groove on your thing, he comes in, hup, hup, everybody up, and organizes a tramp through the woods. After it's all over, some of them ask Keezy for some acid and IT-290 to take back to Palo Alto. No, says Keezy, and he cocks his head as if he wants to say this thing just right, because it's a delicate matter. I think you should come here and take it. Later, on the way back, someone says, we used to be equals, now it's Keezy's trip. We go to his place, we take his acid, we do what he wants. But what does he want? Gradually, vaguely, it dawns that Keezy's fantasy has moved on again, beyond even theirs, old Perry Lane. In any case, nobody has the stomach for Keezy's master plan, that they should all move out onto his place, in tents and so forth, transplanting the Perry Lane thing to La Honda. They began to eye Keezy's place as a kind of hill country Versailles, with Keezy as the Sun King, looking bigger all the time, with that great jaw in profile against the redwoods and the mountaintops. It never develops into an open breach, however, or even disenchantment. They just get uneasy. They get the feeling that Keezy was heading out on further, toward a fantasy they didn't know if they wanted to explore. Other people were beginning to show up at Keezy's, and that was part of the trouble, too. Some of the Perry Lane crowd didn't know exactly what to make of Cassidy. Here he is before us in Keezy's Versailles, coming on, with his shirt off and his arms jerking and his abdominal obliques jutting out at the sides like a weightlifter's. We are hip. We value the holy primitive. Only Keezy is intimating that one should learn from Cassidy. He is talking to you. Which he was. Cassidy wanted intellectual communion, but the intellectuals just wanted him to be the holy primitive, the Denver kid, the natural in our midst. Sometimes Cassidy would sense they weren't accepting him intellectually and go off into the corner, still on his manic monologue, muttering, "All right, I'll take my own trip. I'll go off on my own trip. This is my own trip, you understand." Or Page Browning. The cadaverous cowboy had found his way over the mountain, too. Back on Perry Lane, he had been just a low-rent character popping in from time to time on his route. Only now Keezy is intimating that one can learn from Page Browning. Keezy finds something loyal, brave, and creative. Creative under that cadaverous face and the Adam's apple and the black motorcycle jacket like a leftover from when he must have ridden with the Hell's Angels, and his thick shell-lube pit voice. The primordial shell-lube pits. Could that be it, a little class fear after all among the hip, genteel intellectuals? A little ahor, as Arthur Kessler calls it, the ancient horror from boyhood. The genteel suburban kid rides his bicycle over to the gas station, and there in the grease pit area where they lubricate the cars, the hard rocks are hunkered down telling jokes about pussy, with an occasional clinical reference to bowel movements and crepitation. And, oh Christ, don't you remember their forearms with the basilic veins wrapped around them like surgical tubes, gorged with the unattainable lower-class hard rock power that any moment is going to look up and spot us, genteel little pudding kids? But Kesey loved this low-rent stuff. He was ready to swing with it. In time, he would even be swinging with the beasts from the veritable Ahor fathoms of the Shaloub pits, the Hell's Angels themselves. In fact, only a few of the new retinue that showed up at La Honda were low rent in terms of background, but the place became much more down-home than Perry Lane. One of Kesey's old friends, Kenneth Babbs, showed up, just back from Vietnam, where he had been a captain in the Marines, flying helicopters. Babs had graduated magna cum laude from Miami University, majoring in English. He had also been a great athlete. He entered the creative writing program at Stanford, where Kesey met him. Babs was tall, powerful, a very Rabelaisian creature. Back from the wars, he came on like a great hearty grizzly bear roaring a cosmic laugh. Sometimes he would wear a flight suit for days at a time, no matter where he was. Come fly with me. And Babs was capable of some wild flights. He gave the Kesey colony much of its new style. Yes, he introduced the idea of the pranks, great public put-ons they could perform. And Mike Hagen arrived. Hagen was a fellow Kesey had known in Oregon, good-looking, soft-spoken, well-mannered, from a good family, fairly rich, the kind of kid daddies smile over as he takes their teenage daughter out on her first date. Yep, I've raised her pretty damn well, if I do say so. No riff-raff for my girl, just nice Christian boys who say yes, sir, yes, ma'am, and comb their hair down with water on the comb. About 10 minutes after Hagen pulled into Kesey's, he had his screw shack built out back of the cabin, a lean-to banged together with old boards and decorated inside with carpet remnants, a mattress with an India print coverlet, candles, sparkling little bijoux, a hi-fi speaker, for the delight and comfort of Hagen's girls. Oh, Christ, Hagen's girls and the trouble they caused. Stark, naked, anonymous, but they come later. Hagen was a benign but inspired con man in a sweet way. He had a special gift for haggling, bartering, hassling, and Hagen would turn up with his car crammed with gleaming tape recorder equipment, movie equipment, microphones, speakers, amplifiers, even videotape equipment, and the audio-visual level started rising around here. Then one day, for example, one of Kesey's old Perry Lane friends, Gurney Norman, a writer, drove up for the weekend from Fort Ord, the army camp, and brought along one of his army friends, a 24-year-old first lieutenant in the infantry named Ron Beavert. Beavert put everybody off at first because he looked totally army. He was fat and sloppy-looking and had a particularly gross-looking army crew cut and was totally unsophisticated. Beavert, however, liked them, and he kept coming on weekends and bringing a lot of food, which he enjoyed sharing with everybody, and he smiled and laughed a lot, and people couldn't help but get to like him. By and by he was out of the army, and he came around all the time. He even started getting leaner and harder, and his hair grew out until it was like Prince Valiant's in the comic strip, and he was a pretty handsome guy and very much into the pudding. By and by he became known as the Hassler, and his real name vanished almost. And by and by, of course, the citizens of La Honda and others would start wondering, what are the ninnies doing? How to tell it? But there was no way to tell them about the experience. You couldn't put it into words. The citizens always had the same fantasy, known as the pathology fantasy. These ninnies are pathological. Sometimes it was psychological. What do these kids come from, broken homes or what? Sometimes it was social. Are these kids alienated? Is our society getting rotten at the core, or what? The citizens couldn't know about the LSD experience because that door had never opened for them. To be on the threshold of, Christ, how to tell them about the life here? The youth had always had only three options, go to school, get a job, or live at home. And how boring each was compared to the experience of the infinite and a life in which the subject is not scholastic or bureaucratic, but me and us, the attuned ones amid the non-musical shiny black shoe multitudes, I, with my eyes on that almost invisible hole up there in the red wood sky. One night, Bob Stone was sitting at home in Menlo Park. He was still in the creative writing program at Stanford, and the phone rang, and it was Babs calling from Kesey's in La Honda. "Come on over," he said. "We're going to get something going." "Well, no," Stone said. He didn't feel much up to it. He was kind of tired, and it would take an hour to drive over the mountain, and an hour to drive back, and maybe some other time. "Come on, Bob," says Babs. "It won't take you an hour. You can get here in 30 minutes. Babs is in very high spirits, and in the background, Stone can hear music and voices, and they are indeed getting something going. "I know how long it takes," says Stone, "and it takes 45 minutes or an hour, more like an hour at night." "Listen," says Babs, who was laughing and practically shouting into the phone, "the intrepid traveler can make it in 30 minutes. The intrepid traveler can make it with the speed of light." In the background, Babs can hear a couple of voices rapping off that. "The intrepid traveler! The intrepid traveler! The intrepid traveler," Babs is shouting, "the intrepid traveler just gets up and walks out and he's here." And so on until Stone's resistance wears down and he gets in his car and heads over. He arrives. After an hour, yes. As soon as he gets out of his car out front of the house, he starts hearing the big rap from inside the house, from up in the woods. It's like drums are beating and horns are blowing and pranksters are ululating and rapping. "The intrepid traveler! The intrepid traveler! The intrepid traveler! The intrepid traveler! The intrepid traveler!" He goes through the French doors in the front, mad ochre and lurid lights, gongs, pipes, drums, guitars being banged like percussion bangers. "The intrepid traveler! The intrepid traveler! The traveler in a flash! The intrepid traveler straights out the curves! The intrepid traveler curves out the straights! The intrepid traveler, a beam of light! The intrepid traveler, a lightning beam! The intrepid traveler shortens the circuit! The intrepid traveler shortwaves the band! The intrepid traveler and his band of merry pranksters! The intrepid traveler and his band of merry pranksters take a journey to the east!" Chapter 6. The Bus. I couldn't tell you for sure which of the merry pranksters got the idea for the bus, but it had the Babs touch. It was a super prank in any case. The original fantasy, here in the spring of 1964, had been that Kesey and 4 or 5 others would get a station wagon and drive to New York for the New York World's Fair. On the way, they could shoot some film, make some tapes, freak out on the fair, and see what happened. They would also be on hand in New York for the publication of Kesey's second novel, Sometimes a Great Notion, early in July. So went the original fantasy. Then somebody, Babs, saw a classified ad for a 1939 International Harvester school bus. The bus belonged to a man in Menlo Park. He had a big house and a lot of grounds and a nice set of tweeds and flannels and 11 children. He had rigged out the bus for the children. It had bunks and benches and a refrigerator and a sink for washing dishes and cabinets and shelves and a lot of other nice features for living on the road. Kesey bought it for $1,500 in the name of Intrepid Trips, Incorporated. Kesey gave the word and the pranksters set upon it one afternoon. They started painting it and wiring it for sound and cutting a hole in the roof and fixing up the top of the bus so you could sit up there in the open air and play music, even a set of drums and electric guitars and electric bass and so forth. Or just ride. Sandy went to work on the wiring and rigged up a system with which they could broadcast from inside the bus, with tapes or over microphones, and it would blast outside over powerful speakers on top of the bus. There were also microphones outside that would pick up sounds along the road and broadcast them inside the bus. There was also a sound system inside the bus so you could broadcast to one another over the roar of the engine and the road. You could also broadcast over a tape mechanism so that you said something, then heard your own voice a second later in variable lag, and could rap off of that if you wanted to. Or you could put on earphones and rap simultaneously off sounds from outside, coming in one ear and sounds from inside, your own sounds, coming in the other ear. There was going to be no goddamn sound on that whole trip outside the bus, inside the bus, or inside your own freaking larynx that you couldn't tune in on and rap off of. The painting job, meanwhile, with everybody pitching in a frenzy of primary colors, yellows, oranges, blues, reds, was sloppy as hell, except for the parts Roy Seaburn did, which were nice manic mandalas. Well, it was sloppy, but one thing you had to say for it, it was freaking lurid. The manifest, the destination sign in the front read, "Further," with 2 U's. They took a test run up into Northern California, and right away this wild-looking thing with wild-looking people was great for stirring up consternation and vague befuddling resentment among the citizens. The pranksters were now out among them, and it was exhilarating. Look at the mothers staring, and there was going to be holy terror in the land.